Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 12:55 p.m. That is Pacific Summer Time. Today is August 30th, and we're heading into a holiday weekend in the USA, so there is quite likely to be some volatility on Monday, not least because we've seen plenty of evidence over the course of the last few years where algorithmic traders take advantage of periods when there is less liquidity in the market to try and move those markets. So we can certainly, I think, anticipate some volatility somewhere on Monday. But then there's also, of course, the fact that there is a very significant hurricane going to bear down on Florida this weekend. And it being a holiday weekend, there's a lot of people had been intending to hit the beaches. So that's not going to happen. And this is also what's called a king tide. So just by virtue of the positioning of the moon and the sun, there is already going to be a particularly high tide, and then that is going to exacerbate any kind of storm surge. So there's the potential that things are going to get rather messy in Florida. But what I thought I would talk about to start off with, because this being the big picture long-term audio for the various different asset classes, is the fact that the US government is running an enormous deficit. And I thought that this graphic where it is plotted against the unemployment rate from JP Morgan was particularly interesting, because they're predicting that the federal deficit is going to run in the order of about 4% of GDP beginning in 2020 and running all the way through to 2026. So they're anticipating that the $1 trillion a year deficit that the government is running at the present time in the USA is going to persist pretty much indefinitely. And this is one of the big questions. Unemployment rates are still very low, and we are starting to see that consumer confidence is beginning to turn. Quite whether that is a factor of everything that we've seen over the last 6 months in terms of the trade war is still to be ascertained, but consumer confidence is starting to turn, and consumer confidence would potentially be a lead indicator for unemployment. And we are at extraordinarily low rates in terms of unemployment. In fact, these levels haven't been seen since the late 60s. So I think it is appropriate to start thinking about the fact that not only is the US government running one of the most aggressive pro-cyclical set of policies in the world ever, but also that there is a risk that there is going to be a recession at some point. And of course, central bankers and governments the world over are going to be willing to do anything to avoid the onset of a recession, for the simple reason that because they're already running significant deficits, then that is removing one of the potential policy tools available to them to deal with a future contraction. And if that's the case, well, then that opens up a whole additional Pandora's box of unconventional monetary and fiscal solutions to what is effectively a very significant debt issue. I think the fact that the federal debt of public debt as a percentage of GDP in the USA is in excess of 100%, and in fact has been in excess of 100% for much of the last 5 years, does bear some consideration that there is a very significant quantity of debt outstanding. And that quantity of debt has been growing substantially as a percentage of GDP over the last decade. 10-year Treasury yields are still around the 1.5% level, and this is the lower side of the range that has persisted really since about 2011. So we're talking about an 8-year range here, and there is still a downward bias to the yield. I think this is one of the more important points, that not only do we have a downtrend in treasury yields, but that it's everywhere, that the contraction in yields has got incredible commonality, regardless of what country we look at. In fact, you have to look at incredibly troubled countries like Argentina or Venezuela before you can find yields that might in fact be rising. The German 10-year Bund is at a negative 70 basis points. The quantity of bonds that have got a negative yield exceeded $17 trillion in here today. And the speed with which this index is rising, where it went from 6 trillion in October of 2018, and in the space of less than 12 months has tacked on an additional $11 trillion worth of bonds that now have negative yields. This is stunning. It's something that would previously have been unimaginable. What I found almost risible in here today was that we're having a number of ECB board members coming out and saying that they don't see the need for any additional stimulus. They obviously are not paying attention to the markets. The market has already priced in the significant scope for the ECB to move into negative territory. When, for example, we look at French government bonds, they've moved into negative territory just for the first time in the last couple of weeks. With the new government that we have in Italy, then there is, of course, the question how long it's going to last. Italian administrations do not have a particularly strong record of being able to hold on to power, but what we are seeing is that the Italian government bond yield is now below 1%, and this has been a profound contraction over just the last 2 weeks. So, what we're seeing is in real time the destruction of the European banking sector. There is no way that banks can make money when bonds have got negative yields. And when we contrast the performance of the European banking sector with the banking sectors of most other countries, then the underperformance is really quite, again, another profound signal that the market is sending. There is the potential that the ECB is going to be forced to continue to provide monetary and fiscal stimulus. They have been pretty slow. Our Europeans have been pretty slow to embark upon the fiscal stimulus route because it runs contrary to the Federalist objective to harmonize debt to GDP ratios. And if they do embark upon fiscal stimulus, then that would completely destroy that timetable, which is due to be completed sometime around 2029 or 2030. This assumption that populations are going to quietly sit there and absorb trillions of dollars of, or of euros, in fact, of public debt and pay down these extraordinary debts by accepting much lower living standards is a theory that is being tested by the rise of populism. It's hardly surprising that people are starting to rebel against this ideal when they were never really asked whether they were willing to accept it. The euro is taking some of the pressure from the banking sector, and it was at a new reaction low in here today and pierced the 110 area, so that is extending its downtrend. The pace of the decline is likely to pick up. We can't anticipate that this erosion of the value of the euro is going to persist indefinitely at a modest pace. Eventually, investors will have had enough, and then they will start to sell it more aggressively, and I think that is what we're beginning to see. The European economy looks increasingly likely to move into recession. And that is a rather significant occurrence because Europe is really quite dependent on the economy of China, and China's economy is certainly slowing. So that is a factor that is playing into the fragility that we see in Europe. But then, of course, the trade war is also factoring in. But perhaps more important than that is the reason Europe is so sensitive is because of the structural weaknesses and the fact that a slowdown in global growth can have such a deleterious effect should be sending very clear messages to ECB board members. Then, of course, there is the Japanese example that Japan has been dealing with a deflationary environment domestically for a prolonged period. One of the things that has helped Japan prosper over the course of the last 30 years has been the growth of globalization. If we are in fact moving towards a less globalized world, which appears really quite likely, then we have to at least, that is going to remove one of the potential routes for escape for the European economy. And therefore, we need to see considerably more fiscal and monetary stimulus. The monetary stimulus is so far, has at least so far, made up for the absence of fiscal stimulus. Europe has got just as much of a vested interest in trying to avoid a recession as the USA does. The quantities of debt that are outstanding, the quantities of bad loans that are residing with the banks, and rest of populations that are unwilling to accept the fate being handed down to them by Frankfurt and Brussels, all point towards the requirement for additional stimulus. And that's what the euro is telling us. This the pickup in the pace of the decline is suggesting that Europe is badly in need of additional stimulus. Then the Australian dollar was just about off its lows in here today, but this remains really quite a weak currency. When we look at the trend, there is a short-term oversold condition, but there is a rivetingly consistent sequence of lower rally highs. And in fact, the trend, particularly over the course of the last year and a bit, is quite similar to that of the euro, with the Australian dollar leading somewhat. Australia has got a very significant quantity of debt in the private sector rather than the government sector. That's very similar to what we've seen in, for example, Ireland ahead of the financial crisis. And I think that's a rather important parallel, because when we look at the fact that there is an incredibly large quantity of debt residing in the US, or the Australian consumer, then the government is going to have to provide additional stimulus, and the central bank is already providing monetary stimulus. They're also trying to arrest the decline in the housing market on a year-over-year basis. It's been falling since 2017, and in some places prices are down 40%. So there is obviously a challenge here for the Australian property markets. What we are starting to see, however, is that the stimulative measures that have been introduced are at least helping to stabilize the banking sector, and the banks have started to turn around. This is, again, in sharp contrast to what we've seen, for example, in Europe. Europe is lagging, and they're definitely going to have to demonstrate that the stimulus is going to be forthcoming, but the stock market is starting to steady from the region of the trend mean. What is also particularly interesting right now is the interest rate differentials between bonds and equities. The FTSE 100 is the poster child for that particular argument, because the index itself is yielding 5.11%, and gilt yields are somewhere in the region of about a half of 1%. So there is a really rather significant pickup in yield by investing in equities. And so far, there has been some reticence to do so because of the uncertainty surrounding Brexit. I continue to think that the policy that Boris Johnson has pursued, which is to try and lend some credibility to the argument that the UK will leave the EU without a deal unless it gets what it wants, is by far the most sensible policy, because to do anything else virtually ensures that the UK will not get what it wants and will end up with a deal that is unfavourable and therefore very unlikely to pass muster in the House of Commons. The pound has been steadying, and what that is beginning to price in is the market is coming around to the idea that the UK is more likely to get a deal that it wants if they play hardball. Of course, the hard Brexit argument, and certainly the argument being propounded by Nigel Farage of the Brexit Party, is that a hard Brexit is the only way to go. But unfortunately, that is a minority view, and it is, I think, quite likely that a deal of some form is going to be signed, because it's probably the only thing that can, in fact, get past Parliament. That suggests that there is scope for the pound to steady further, but we're likely to see a great deal of volatility. We are seeing that the weakness of the pound has created a relative valuation disparity between the UK and just about everywhere else in the developed world. And it does suggest that once we have an answer to the Brexit question, that the UK is going to become a favourable destination for foreign investment flows. So I do think this is a market that is worth monitoring closely, perhaps more interesting today than it has been at any point really in the last 3 years, because we are coming increasingly close to some form of resolution to the question. It's been my opinion, and it was certainly David's opinion, that the UK was better off outside the EU. The sclerosis and in decision making within the EU, and the federalist project that would never have been voted through by the populations of the EU if they'd ever been given a choice, is obviously something that is alien to a significant number of people, and the UK is simply the only country that has had a referendum on the question. When we think about what is in fact going on, well, despite all of the worries about a trade war and what it means for the corporate sector, I think it is rather interesting to point out that first, the S&P 500 is very close to its all-time peak. And if it weren't for the pop on the upside in the summer, then it would be pretty close, it would really be within a few points of its all-time peak. We've had a meaningful rebound from the region of the trend mean in here this week, and that was on the whisper, or the whiff, of some improvement in the trade war. I think the trade war is something that is not going to go away. It's going to ebb and flow. There were two important announcements over the course of the last week. The first was that 200 corporations signed up to a project developed by JP Morgan to say that their primary ambition is no longer profits, but that they also need to consider the welfare of their workers and the environment, and that they are nominating themselves for the environmental, social, and governance type of investment structure. I've spoken with a number of ESG fund managers over the course of the last few months. Some of them do say that there is money flowing in. What most of them have reported was that there are people certainly making a lot of noise about wanting to invest, but then they don't actually follow through with the capital afterwards. But one of the conversations I had with someone who was selling investments in timber was that she's had people coming along who were inheriting a substantial quantity of money, and all they wanted was to have an investment in something environmental, and they didn't care about the return. So that is a sign that people are willing to make some decisions about investing in the ESG sector. And there's a strong likelihood that it could be generational in terms of what money is and being allocated where. But I think it is rather interesting. And I think it is also a clear sign of the times that investors are willing to make investments without a profit motivation. And that's obviously that's a symptom of a bull market that's persisted for over a decade, that they don't worry about making a profit because it's already assumed. They don't worry about making a profit because they can't imagine a time when they won't be flush with cash. These are the kinds of people that tend to go through a trial of fire when there is a recession. We know that central banks, and particularly the Federal Reserve, is going to do whatever they can to avoid a recession because they don't want to have to dip into the box of incredibly extraordinary measures to try and monetize the debt. But there are massive unfunded liabilities. There is a significant proportion of the population that has been promised pensions that are massively underwater. And what that suggests is that we're going to see stimulus over the course of the next year and a half or 2 years that is aimed at prolonging the expansion. But the yield curve is inverted. And what that is generally being is a lead indicator for future recessions. And the deeper into negative territory it goes, then the greater the likelihood is that we are going to have a recession. What's also worth highlighting is that student debt delinquency is something I think we should watch, because of the quantity of debt that is outstanding, and delinquencies have been rising persistently, so that does represent a factor, particularly for something like SLM Corp, which is the Fannie and Freddie of the federal student loans. Then there is also auto loan delinquency. Because when we think about what is it that people have been spending money on, well, the credit crisis inhibited the ability of many people to source credit for houses, and lending standards tightened up a lot. So we haven't had the same bubble in housing, but we did have significant numbers of people buying very expensive pickup trucks. So auto loans are starting to tick higher, but credit card delinquency, which would be the fallback for the vast majority of people who run into trouble with their credit, then credit card delinquencies are still really very low. And there is, because of the rise in housing prices, And because of the fact that mortgage rates have been coming down aggressively, then there is the potential here that we're going to get a very significant quantity of mortgages that are refinanced, with a round trip over the last 18 months from 3.5 up to 5% and back down again, then there is a rather significant quantity of mortgages that can be refinanced at much lower levels. That is going to plug a significant quantity of additional cash into people's pockets. When you can shave 100 basis points off your mortgage, then that's rather significant. It's the quantity of equity that people are holding in their homes is in the order of $6.5 trillion. So that's a rather significant quantity of cash. Of course, a bear would highlight that it's all ephemeral because in the event of a recession, then all of that additional equity is going to evaporate. But the ability of people to borrow and service those debts is something that can help to inflate a bubble before you get a recession. And I do think that's where the base case is, that oil prices are definitely not surging higher. And in fact, they were down today in about 65 cents. But it really does need to bounce and bounce in a very substantial manner in order to confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. This is a result of the game-changing nature of the shale revolution. There is been a massive geopolitical change where the USA had once been by far the largest consumer of oil. It is now one of the biggest exporters and effectively the swing producer. It's the swing producer not because it has the cheapest oil, but because it has the most elastic supply. Saudi Arabia can afford to, can attempt at least to pump less, but their financial commitments in terms of the quantity of, or the proportion of state spending that oil represents is an inhibiting factor in terms of just how much they can cut. Whereas one of the, I think, underappreciated aspects of the shale revolution is that they can just stop drilling and supply will stop because of the early peak rates of unconventional wells. Now, that will have an effect on some of the smaller companies. It will have an effect on the more leveraged side of the energy sector and energy high yield is starting to appreciate because of the pressure that is coming to bear on some of these companies. Those yields are moving higher, and high yield represents about 12 to 15% of the, excuse me, energy high yield represents about 15% of the total high yield sector. But high yield bonds generally are still reasonably well contained in terms of their spread. It's still around 420 basis points. That's significantly above where it was in 2017 and 2018, but it's not pushing through the 5% area. And it would need to be pushing through 5% in order to really have a deleterious effect on the overall stock market. One of the, I think, bigger picture potential items here is that because of the desire of central banks to avoid a recession, then they are quite likely to spur a bubble. And I think that has to be the base case. When we look at what kind of sectors could potentially lead in that environment, well, consumer staples are pushing new highs. And they're doing that because of the reliability of their cash flows and their bond-like characteristics. With this compression in yields that is global in nature, then anything with a positive yield and bond-like characteristics is getting bid up. And That's also the case for the utilities sector, and the utilities continue to push on to new highs. So if we then think about the for example, the cybersecurity sector, I think anyone who has ever purchased a cybersecurity package, then you're pretty much locked in. I think in our home we have three different subscriptions to Kaspersky, or it maybe not be Kaspersky, it might be VMware. I can't remember which one it is, but I definitely know we just renewed it. Well, we can look at the cybersecurity ETF, and it is starting to bounce from the region of the trend mean, or at least steadying in here. Then, when we think about Microsoft, well, Microsoft had been a particularly cyclical business, but it has turned itself into a highly modelable. And sorry, I didn't press the right button there. We can, for example, look at the trend between approximately 2000 and 2013, and there was a lot of ebb and flow. There were some good years and there were some bad years, and it was a victim of the necessity of trying to support previous versions of its software while also coming up with the next one. Got a boost from sales when it came out with a new one, and then those sales evaporated once everyone who wanted to buy it had bought it, and then the cycle starts again. By embarking upon a subscription business model, then they can ensure that all customers have the most recent software, and that reduces the cost of maintaining it. And then they can simply work at improving their product and have a constant stream of sales. And since they adopted a subscription business model, the share has done nothing but go up. Adobe was the first company to adopt this kind of strategy, and it has also continued to trend higher. Autodesk has got a pretty much a monopoly on video editing subscriptions, and that share is bouncing from the region of its sequence of higher reaction lows in here this week. So these are the kinds of companies that will benefit from the evolution of a subscription business model and its appreciation by investors as a bond proxy, because the bubble in this cycle is very clearly in the bond markets. We've had a massive quantity of debt that has been issued. We've had an enormous number of loans, particularly leveraged loans, that have been taken out. Then we also have the fact that because the interest rate has been so low and because liquidity has been so available, then that has funded the enhancement of balance sheets, or perhaps the better way to think about it is increasing leverage of balance sheets so that they can borrow at very low rates. Initially, that was reducing the weighted average cost of capital. It was paying down more expensive debt. It was essentially a refinancing operation. And that's now been transformed into simply buybacks and paying for increasing dividends. What's particularly interesting is that we would have anticipated that with share buybacks, then investors could have anticipated that the supply of equities would have contracted. But that hasn't really happened. What we've instead seen is that option awards to investors have pretty much counterbalanced the number of shares that have been taken out of the market through buybacks, with the net result that the number of shares is pretty similar. And I think that is a testament to, or at least that is what we're seeing in terms of the performance of the market. Because if the quantity of equities that had been bought back by companies had not been absorbed by option issuance, the stock market would already be at a multiple of where it is today. What I find most particularly interesting is that the Nasdaq, for example, has been ranging over the course of the last 6 or 7 months in the region of the peak from back in 2018. And this looks like a bullish consolidation. And as long as it is trading above that 7,000 level, we can continue to conclude that it is a bullish consolidation. Eventually, we're going to see that if a bubble does evolve, and I do think that there is a rational argument for thinking that we are already seeing the effects of a bubble on bond proxy type of investments, then that is something that is eventually going to lead to extraordinary valuations. It's also going to lead to a lot of the cash that's already on the sidelines being committed. That's one of the most important factors, that if we just look around at what investment banks have been advising, they've been advising people to raise cash for most of the last 18 months. And yet, stock markets are increasingly firming from the region of their respective trend means and potentially on the cusp of breaking out to new high ground. Well, when you start to see markets pushing on to new high ground, then, and against a background where we've seen that they've been ranging for a prolonged period, well, ranges are explosions waiting to happen. And all the people that wanted to buy at the lows in December and failed to do so, well, they're going to have to start committing capital or they run the very severe risk of underperforming. And the longer the breakout persists, the greater the pressure is will there will be to recommit capital. It's usually when we have people that are fully invested, and already then we start to see that we've had an inverted yield curve, the banking sector is not doing particularly well, and there is more pronounced slowdown in demand. That's usually when you get a recession. It's also worth considering that when you do get a recession, or when you get an, excuse me, when you get an inverted yield curve, it's a lead indicator of anything from 6 to 18 months, and potentially even longer, before you actually get the recession. And in that period, where the economy is still holding up okay, but monetary policy is already starting to ease, that's when you can see the bubble evolve. In 1998, when the market first, or when the yield curve first became inverted, the Nasdaq went up another 50%. In 2006, when the yield curve first went inverted, the market went up another 30%. And we already have an enormous amount of cash on the sidelines. There is a huge quantity of monetary stimulus on the way. There is already fiscal stimulus. And in fact, what we're seeing in the USA for the first time is combined monetary and fiscal stimulus. We haven't seen that since 2009. We had quantitative easing. Then we had the balance sheet runoff at exactly the same time that the Trump administration embarked on fiscal stimulus. Then they stopped reducing the size of the balance sheet, and now we're getting fiscal and the potential for monetary stimulus concurrently. And that is likely to drive another upleg in this bull market. Eventually, we are going to get a recession. And it's at that point that the bubble in bonds is going to come under pressure. I think that it's potentially that we're going to start seeing some of the money coming out of the bond markets and potentially back into the equity markets if the stock market starts to break higher. Not least because of the very substantial issuance that the US government has got planned over the course of the next 6 to 8 months. With the massive fiscal stimulus that has been agreed, with $1.2 trillion that has been agreed between now and the end of 2020, well, that's something that is going to have to result in additional bond issuance. And we're already seeing an accelerating environment in the bond markets. What I think is likely is eventually we're going to have to see a even further competitive devaluation of currencies. The size of the debts that have been accrued are so large that monetization of those debts, either through modern monetary theory or other means, is already baked into the system. And that is why gold is doing better. It's also why gold is doing better in commodity currencies. If we, I think, look at gold since about 1990, then we can see that we had a very prolonged base formation and a very pronounced bull market and a long period of ranging after the peak in 2011. It's when we start to look at it in other currencies that we can see where there was because of the weakness of the Australian dollar, for example, gold pretty much went sideways after 2011 and then has just broken out. It's also worth considering that gold went up less in the bull market in Australia because of the strength of the currency. So there are two ways of thinking about all of this. The first is that the gold price is, our gold is a monetary metal, so it does best when the currencies it's being compared against are being devalued. That's certainly true of the commodity currencies right now because of the weakness in China. And China's economy is weakening, and the quantity of debt that has been built up there is quite profound. So that's an additional point. Then, of course, the gold price in euro moved on to a new all-time high this week, and not least because of the weakness of the euro. The US government is embarking upon fiscal stimulus, and the Federal Reserve is embarking on monetary stimulus, but the US economy is still stronger than most other governments or most other countries. So that so far has helped the dollar index remain really quite steady. And when we look at this trend, the upward dynamic we saw this week is one of the strongest we've seen over the course of the last 18 months. It rather increases the potential that the index is going to push on to test that 100 level, and it may not stop there. When we look at the broad dollar, then this gives us a more correct outlook for where the dollar has been trading for a prolonged period. And the broad dollar index is pushing new highs, or very close to it. And this is a significant factor in terms of the continued demand for US assets. The fact that the semiconductors index in the USA is still holding this move up to new high ground over the second half of this year, I think, is a real testament to the strength of that market. I'm very much of the opinion that China's markets are a trader's market today. It is not a place where one can commit money for the long term. I'm also rather concerned that that's a minority view. standards of governance are incredibly important. And one of the most basic questions that anyone who's investing in a foreign jurisdiction has is whether they can withdraw their assets once they have made the investment. And that's becoming an increasingly more difficult prospect in China. The other point is that China has clearly stated under Xi Jinping's administration that they want to become the global hegemon. They want to become the global superpower. They want to become completely independent of U.S. Exports. They want to become the technological superpower. And they're building a blue water navy to help address their incapacity on a military front. It's obvious that that intention is going to come up against at least some resistance, and that's where the trade war is really starting. Well, not only did we have 200 corporations this week saying that their primary motivation is no longer profits, but then you had the Trump administration telling U.S. Companies that they need to start cutting their ties to China. That's part of the reason why the trade war is ebbing and flowing, because you can't simply institute a new Cold War overnight. The companies have to be given the opportunity to try and excise themselves from the Chinese market. Against the background where the trade war has been the focus of attention, the fact that Costco, which again is another subscription business model company, opened its first store in Shanghai and was well rewarded for the positive news flow that came from that. Well, I wonder how successful is it going to be, but perhaps more importantly, how successful will it be allowed to be? China has pretty much run out of goods that it can tax on a tariff front, and therefore it is going to have to adopt additional measures. And one set of measures that it can adopt is boycott. So that is a very significant potential issue. One thing that the CEO of Cisco has been quoted as saying was that the company is no longer being invited to bid for Chinese projects. So they are being cut out from the Chinese market. They may not have a choice about whether they want to be in China or not. They just simply won't get any business there. And that is, I think, where we are heading. There, so far, the trade war has ebbed and flowed because it simply just takes time for companies to get the message. It takes time to build factories elsewhere, and that is something that is likely to take years in to achieve. But Hanhai Precision, which is famous for having a million workers in China, has got two factories now in India, and with approximately 27,000 workers. They're aiming at radically increasing that workforce and their footprint within India. Well, that is likely to be strongly beneficial for the Indian market. What I find also rather interesting is that the 10-year yield in India has contracted really quite impressively over the course of the last 3 months. Now, we have seen some profit-taking occurring over the course of the last 3 weeks, and there are efforts underway to begin to consolidate the state banking sector. That will be positive in terms of creating more efficiency within the state banking sector. But what we really need to see in India is some form of effort to address the illiquidity in the housing finance sector. Something that we don't look at particularly often is the broad Indian market. The vast majority of commentary is on the Nifty, which is only 50 shares. If we look at the broad market, it has been bouncing over the course of the last 2 weeks from the lower side of this range that's persisted over the last 18 months. We definitely had two-year consolidations previously. The last one was in 2015 and 2016. So the fact that government bond yields are low and that oil prices have are reasonably well contained, that does offer the RBI the potential to cut interest rates. And the rupee was in positive territory in here today, but it has got work to do in order to really demonstrate that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. The reality is that governments the world over are rather eager to devalue their currencies. That's particularly true in the emerging markets as a result of China's devaluation. It's true in the commodity currencies because of the reliance that they have on the industrial resources and oil. The London Metals Index is still trending downwards. The one very clear breakout and return to performance that we've seen is in the nickel market, and it was up in a very dynamic manner in here today on news that Indonesia is going to limit its exports of ore. So that's a clear breakout and the resumption of an uptrend. Nickel is it is likely to be one of the primary feedstocks for the new batch of batteries that are going to be installed in lots of new cars from 2021 onwards, or really even 2020, and the nickel that is required is of a much purer standard than is easily available today. So that represents a supply and elasticity argument, and it does suggest we're going to see higher prices for nickel. It's also, I think, noteworthy that the Baltic Dry Index is pushing on to new recovery highs. Part of the reason that it's doing that is because of the IMO 2020. And that the number of ships that are going to be available for that, or at least for trade, when those regulations come into effect, is going to be reduced. And this also represents a supply and elasticity argument. There is the clear potential that shipping rates are going to increase. Well, shipping rates increasing is directly inflationary. And inflation is something that no one is willing to price in at present. But the conditions for an inflationary outcome are almost baked into the intention, or at least the fear and eventual intention, of central bankers and governments to monetize their debt. It is impossible for them to meet their obligations, and therefore the only answer is going to be to inflate those debts away. And with government bond yields at such low levels, and the fact that gold prices are already starting to move higher, that the gold shares are starting to improve as well, these are, I think, factors that are beginning to price in an inflationary outcome. And inflation at the moment is not a particularly expensive hedge, because nobody really considers that it is going to occur. It's deflation that people are worried about right now. But it's also worth considering that we get an inflationary scare in the latter stages of bull markets. It's one of the things that inhibits central bankers from cutting rates more. And then that creates the contraction that leads to the recession. And there is the potential that we are on the cusp of seeing an inflation scare, not least because of the quantity of debt that needs to be refinanced. And we're starting to see bond auctions fail. The the German government failed in its auction of zero interest bonds. Well, we might say thank God, or at least that required at least some modicum of backbone for investors to say no. But 7-year yields, and again, there was a justification for that. There was the rationalization was that the 7-year bonds are not especially favored by investors. So the failure of that auction over the last 2 days was also brushed off. But what we are starting to see is bond investors rebelling. And that's something that has the potential to have a really quite significant effect on the bond markets. So I do think that despite the fact that the quantity of debt has just ticked over 17 trillion, that having an unhedged or having a long position in these bonds without a stop is rather suicidal. That eventually we are going to see a pullback, we're going to see at least a reversion to the mean. And that is something that is going to represent a very big move in some of these very overextended bonds. When I think about the longer term, I don't think the trade war is going to end anytime soon. I think that this does represent a change, that the tide of globalization is starting to ebb, that the change is most, I think, clear in terms of the bear market we're seeing in energy, and the increasing potential for just-in-time manufacturing to occur in a local area. The automation of the manufacturing process, the increasing impact of artificial intelligence on the economy. Those types of factors do not require a global supply chain. And the strength of a domestic demand story is going to become even more important. Well, that suggests that we are going to move into a more antagonistic geopolitical environment. And again, the energy sector is a direct source of that increasing potential geopolitical tension because the biggest consumer has become one of the biggest producers. But we are still in the in a very rapid period of technological innovation, and that is likely to continue to exert a deflationary force. And these are, I think, very closely intertwined themes. The rise of the global consumer is as much about creating manufacturing jobs in India as it is in East Africa. China has already gone over the hump in terms of its demographic dividend, and the country is aging faster than just about anywhere else, even in a nat it, just in the nat the natural course of events. We could anticipate that manufacturing would start to migrate away from China. So there is, I think, ample scope for additional upside in gold, and that's despite the fact that we have short-term overbought condition. I think that bonds do represent a bubble and are a clear risk. There is the clear potential that we are entering the bubble phase for the equity markets, and because we have an inverted yield curve, the clock is ticking on a recession, but it could be anything up to 2 years from now. If I had to guess, and it is simply a guess, then the pricing in of the outcome of the US presidential election and what that's going to mean in terms of support for businesses and the deficits of the federal government is, I think, going to be a catalytic event in terms of the outlook for the stock market and the bond markets. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I wish all the best to all of you.